Today is the 2nd of August 2023, and the time is 3:15 p.m. My name is Preeti Shree Venkatram, and I'm conducting the fifth session of an interview with Pradeep Krishan for the Making of Indian Conservation Project. This session would focus specifically on conservation-related perspectives. I'm in my home in Bangalore, and Mr. Krishan is in his home in Delhi. Today, I would like to begin by asking, in the larger landscape of restoration and conservation in the country over the last 50 years, where do you place yourself? How do you see your roles and responsibilities, and how do you see their relevance?
Okay, so I think it's important to remind anybody who is listening to this that I didn't start out as a person who was practicing restoration or even conservation. There is a clear sense in which it happened through a series of fortuitous accidents. It's something that when I started working in the desert in Rajasthan and started restoration, it was very much a kind of individual project that grew, in scope and in relevance to lots of other, dry, arid places in the desert. But I didn't certainly not the beginning. I didn't see myself as participating in some grand, restoration scheme. Nor did I relate to. I mean, there was very little restoration work happening in the country at that time. I was not aware, in fact, of any restoration work happening, except to a limited extent in very childish schemes to try and, undo the damage that mining work, for example, sometimes does to a landscape, and then they'd basically try and cover the stones up and plant some trees on it, and that's the only kind of restoration that India was practicing at all. If you cut to the present, it's quite a different scenario. I think I mentioned before that in September of last year we had what is probably the first convention of practitioners of ecological restoration convening in Jodhpur under the auspices of the Ecological Restoration Alliance, which we'd formed. And I think we will look back on this as early days. It really is, in a sense, it probably marks the beginnings of private players, of individuals and NGOs, beginning to think that perhaps by linking hands and by sharing information, there is a role for us to play. At the same time, I'm very aware, Preeti, that all the land is held by the Forest Department, largely by other arms of government, if it's not the Forest Department. And we do look with great envy at the fact that there are these huge wild tracts that could do with restoration but are not available to us. Because the Forest Department, I mean, I can imagine a scenario where the Forest Department says, look, why don't you partner with us and help us to do this? Because you have a perspective, at least a perspective about a particular kind of ecology. But they don't do that. The Forest Department tends to be very suspicious of outsiders, of scientists, of ecological, restoration people. So we really haven't got a foot in the door when it comes to the larger project. All of us are working on habitats that are 100 hectares, maybe 200 hectares at best, really small, tiny chunks of land. We're learning the job, we're learning the challenges, we're learning by making our mistakes. But we're not able to apply what we have learned to really significant chunks of landscape and habitat. And we're not, I think perhaps the most negative thing about all this is that we're not able to actually work with people who live in wild landscapes, with indigenous people, perhaps involve them in all the decisions that they could possibly take about the future of their landscape. So that's a huge thing missing from the work that we do at this moment. I personally believe it would be, I mean, a huge challenge, but hugely exciting to be able to actually work with with people who live, who have lived for centuries in a particular landscape, and to partner with them to see how we can think of the right kind of solutions for how to restore their land. At the same time, let me just say this, that I'm deeply suspicious of restoration noises that the government has started to make. I mean, last year was the year of ecological restoration. The government of India touts the fact that the Modi government had committed to restore 29 million hectares of degraded forest in the Bonn Declaration. We have consistently found no evidence that any of this restoration has actually been done, even though there are specific claims that the government has already restored 11 million hectares. And whenever we've asked the ministry or anybody else about where these 11 million hectares lie, who has done the restoration, what species were involved, what is the kind of ecology, there are no answers at all. And some of the suspicions are that the government is actually counting the kind of rubbishy tree planting that happens along highways, and they measure the length of the highway and they multiply it by the width of the tree planting site, and they claim that that is restoration of so many hectares. So it's the truth is that I'm not familiar with the forest departments of every part of this country. I've come to know the forest departments of Madhya Pradesh to some extent, of Rajasthan to a greater extent. And I think it would be fair to say that at this moment, the forest departments of India are not on a pathway where they know what restoration is. I remember last year when I was on a Supreme Court committee with Dr. Ranjit Singh, the head of the FRI sent us a picture of tulips growing in the mountains, and they said that this is our forest department doing restoration work in the mountains. It's absurd. It sounds absurd, but many of the claims are this absurd. And we've seriously thought about trying to create a curriculum that we can introduce into the training that is received by new recruits to the forest department, so that at least they're beginning to become aware of the cross currents and the winds of change. But at the moment, the forest department doesn't even have nurseries of native plants. It has at best 6, 7, 8 species of trees that grow in their landscapes. They're not really concerned with the grasses or the herbaceous species or the sedges or anything. I have a sense that at this moment of time, ecological restoration is something that is only being thought about by a small handful of maybe 150 people who do what they can, but in the little interstices between the large chunks of wildlands, instead of actually doing it on these wildlands. For every project that I've done, there are probably 3 or 4 projects that have fallen by the wayside. So there's a huge level of attrition. There's a huge level of things not working out. When you are restoring, you need a tremendous degree of support from the people who are stakeholders, the people who own the land. That's not always forthcoming. It's not always something that they understand. We feel like a really embattled lot of people. What we see is that, I mean, let me take, for example, the case of the Central Ridge in Delhi, mm-hmm. which is a huge kind of 8 square kilometer chunk of dry deciduous forest that is now severely degraded because of the invasive Prosopis juliflora that was planted in the 1920s. We have an opportunity, we think, to create the greatest natural forest that any capital city in the world has. In fact, what's happening on the ridge is that, you know, there was a move last year by a certain gentleman who is a retired botanist to restore the ridge with the Forest Department, and he did a presentation to us, and I was one of the members of the advisory committee. And he said that we're going to restore the Central Ridge to its pristine self, and we're going to make it like New York Central Park. And we said, hey, wait a minute. What is New York Central Park is not a restored site, you know? So what is the correspondence that you're seeing? And he said, no, we're going to have handball courts and tennis courts and things like, you know, and there was completely no understanding at all. He wants to completely change the hydrological sort of situation on the ridge. He wants to dig trenches. He wants to have anicuts. He wants to, you know, make it a moist biome. He was suggesting tree species that you don't get in Delhi, because he said these are Aravali species, but these are Aravali species that you find in Udaipur and further south, which are 800 kilometers away from Delhi. So we had a huge sort of argument with him. And subsequently, he left the project in disgust. But the Forest Department now is doing the restoration itself. And as recently as 3 weeks ago, we found a buzz of activity in the Central Ridge, where basically chinar trees, platanus from you know, the same tree that is celebrated in Kashmir, in the valley of Kashmir, have been brought in the thousands to the ridge because they want to make the ridge like the Vale of Kashmir. Now, I don't know whether to laugh or to cry. This is apparently a suggestion by the Lieutenant Governor of Delhi, and the Forest Department doesn't seem to have the spine to be able to say, look, these trees will not grow here. If we want them to grow, we may have to look after them, we may have to water them, we may have to give them nutrients, we may have to do all kinds of things that can't be done on such a large scale. But the point is, they haven't done it. And now, over the last week, again, we've seen them suddenly starting a whole lot of road building in the ridge. So we're probably seeing the start of the dismantling of the ridge, and the dismantling of any dream of actually being able to restore it to a really beautiful, dry, deciduous forest, you know, that Delhi could use. So lots of despondency that I see in terms of what the government, how the government thinks and how it responds to these things. I mean, the recent bill to, you know, modify the Forest Conservation Act is just another example of how lip service is paid to certain, you know, certain ideals that were first enshrined in the FCA of the 1980s, but there's a constant whittling away of the efficacy of these laws in order to be able to build more infrastructure, to be able to hand over land to industry, and essentially to say that, look, none of this is really necessary. So I'm drawing a picture, Preeti, of a government which certainly for the last, you know, 15 years or so, and possibly longer than that, doesn't really have any deep-seated commitment to conservation as we think it should, in the way that we think it should. Despondent view of what's happening. But I don't see any reason to modify that view. It's not, you know, the government is not into consulting people like us. It's not into wanting to, you know, I mean, we hear of other countries which may not be light in our situation at all, but we hear of other countries where, you know, you can see that there's an attempt on the part of government to actually address some of these issues. That's not happening in this country at all. I think the whole sort of carbon business, the whole, you know, the whole business of trying to make international commitments is really just hogwash as far as India is concerned. So I'm afraid that's the way I see it. I see it as being a very cynical walking of the line in such a way that you're saying the right things to the international community, but you're not doing the right things when it actually comes to policy and practice in this country.
I was going to specifically ask, reflecting on the last 50 years of conservation in India, what are some major successes and failures? You've, of course, spoken a bit already about what you see are some failures, for example, of the government. I was wondering if there's anything else that comes to your mind with regard to failures of conservation, and even on the flip side, any successes or anything that you think has been done right?
I think looking back in a long perspective, I think right from the Wildlife Protection Act onwards, definitely there was progress over what was happening before that. That, as well as the Forest Conservation Act, were definitely milestones. We inherited a system of forestry that was basically based on a Germanic idea of what they call the high forest, that forests were to be managed for their use value. The ideal forest was an even-aged forest of consisting only of those species that were useful to human beings. And that was something that had really been put into place even before independence, and it continued. And the Forest Conservation Act was the first time that this issue was actually addressed in terms of policy, and at least in word, there was an attempt to reverse it, although we saw for many, many years after that, that in actual practice, the Forest Department, and especially the forest corporations of some of the states that I was aware of, they hadn't taken it on board. It was as if the law existed out there, but they were continuing to actually, you know, cut forests in a particular, you know, and replace it with say teak, for example, in places where teak does not grow naturally. So there was a bit of a disjunct between the actual law and the idea. But I don't think there's any doubt that, you know, during Mrs. Gandhi's regime, there were people in government, in responsible positions, who influenced policy that led to the Wildlife Protection Act, and then to the FCA. That was definitely something that was, it was a big advance on what had existed before that. I think that statistics, really, when you look at sort of forest losses, when you look at the way things have actually happened on the ground, it's a pretty dismal picture. People are crowing about tiger numbers going up and things like that. And, you know, I think that same time, there are so many places where tiger numbers have now become unviable. You know, something like, I think there were 30 or 40 places cited where there were tiger numbers were now completely unviable. And I'm not sure that tigers are the right metric to use when you're actually assessing, you know, the health of an ecosystem. I realized something when I was working on my book on the jungle trees of Central India. I was looking to take photographs of trees in their natural setting, and I was looking for a good example of an Acacia nilotica, now called Vachellia nilotica, growing in the jungle. And I didn't see one. And I began to doubt whether Vachellia nilotica was actually a native forest tree, and all the books seem to suggest that it was. But then why wasn't I seeing it in a jungle setting? And a year or a year and a half went by, and I was visiting jungle after jungle, and I didn't ever see this tree, the babul, growing inside the national park. And it took me a while, but I finally realized that this was a tree that actually signaled the presence of arable land. It's a tree that grows in very good loamy soil where the water is not too deep underground. So wherever the babul grows, it's basically saying here lies good agricultural land. So wherever the babul grew, that land had already been taken over. So in a way, the national park boundaries or the reserves, the reserved forest boundaries or the PA boundaries were all being actually created after all the arable land had been taken away. So we're really only now preserving and looking after, at least in the areas that I know well, which is mostly, you know, all of Madhya Pradesh, parts of Rajasthan, we're looking at stony, rocky hillsides where there isn't such a good arable land. And that's a comment about what we've possibly lost and what we, you know, what we're preserving now. It's something that's important to take on board, because the babul is probably only one of several trees that enjoy a similar kind of ecology. They're all similarly missing from national parks and protected areas. So you know, I'm sorry to sound as pessimistic as I probably am sounding, but I'm not encouraged by the tenor and the tone of the way in which the government and its arms and state governments and the state governments are often under the control of different political parties. But I don't see reason for hope in the near future from this, you know, these particular formations that are in charge of our wildlands.
About 2 years ago, in a series called Cross Border Conversations organized by STIR, I'd seen the video uploaded on YouTube. You'd mentioned that you feel depressed every time you visit the Forest Research Institute. And even earlier in this conversation, you mentioned about your views about them. I was just wondering whether that has always been your feeling or if this has changed in any way over time, and maybe if you could just elaborate a bit more on that.
Well, you have to remember that I've only really been involved in this field, in this sector, since about 2003, 2004. So I haven't known the FRI except as a site, except for, you know, for the last 20 years or so. Yeah, I have absolutely no reason to revise that feeling, Preeti. I've not. I've interacted with some officers from the Forest Research Institute, the ICFRE. There are some good officers there. There are some good forest officers everywhere. I mean, in Madhya Pradesh, Rajasthan, I met some really passionate, wonderful people. But they don't seem to be able to influence the course of policy or practice in a way that is meaningful. Several years ago, when we were starting to work in Jaipur on a park, I was asked by the Forest Department in Jaipur to whether we were willing to help to restore some degraded mines, which were quite far away, about 400 kilometers away. And I said, look, we don't have the bandwidth to be working in Jaipur as well as working 400 kilometers away. But I said, why don't we start to show you what you can possibly do to the rocky parts of the Aravali that lead into Jaipur on the main highway from Delhi? And I said, all we need to do is, you know, allot 6 or 7 hectares, just a tiny portion of a hill, so that we can show you what we can do as a sample and give us Forest Department personnel so that we can create a protocol that they can then enhance to any degree they want, you know, and then apply it to whatever else they want to do. And I thought it would be a brilliant way to be able to actually impart some training to some people in the forest department. But it never worked out. They eventually didn't want to do it for whatever reason. So, you know, there have been several such incidents where you come very close, perhaps, to clinching something where you think perhaps you can bring the forest department in to learn something or to partner with us, to do something together. It's never worked out for us before, at least for me before. I know that I have friends in the ecological restoration space in Kerala and in Tamil Nadu who have had some success in working with the forest department. So, you know, this is, so I'm not making some blanket statement, but it just, in my personal experience, it's not been something that I've been able to do or to be able to count on.
Something else that I was wanting to ask was if you could broadly comment on any specific principles or strategies that guide your work. You've of course mentioned planting what's native to the area a couple of times and also working with people who are from the area. But I was wondering if there was anything in addition to these.
Are you saying that in a broad brush way? You want me to comment on what could be done in all these places?
Have there been any strategies or principles that have guided your work so far? And also, also it's okay to also say what you think ought to be the case, maybe even if it's not something you do.
Yeah, well, essentially, the methodology that I started with that has served me very well is to try and look very carefully at what are now called reference sites, reference situations. I wasn't using that term when I first did it, but because the first big project that I worked on was actually restoring the ecology of the what became the Rao Jyotha Desert Rock Park, and because I knew so little, I had so little experience or knowledge about the desert, every time I went into the desert, it was a journey of learning, of noticing, of taking notes and trying to understand how wild plants exist in a rocky substrate. And there's nothing that can replace that. I mean, obviously, if your science is really good, if you have loads of experience, you've done lots of experimentation, you can go beyond that. But that is the basic attitude with which you have to, you know, start to work with any landscape, that you choose a reference site wherever you're working, whether you're working in a rainforest, whether you're working in a grassland, whether you're working by the side of the river. You need to actually look for a reference site that approximates the conditions in which you are working. You need to look for a similar rock type with the same minerals. You need to look for something that has the same rainfall, the same moisture regime, the same kind of soil, same kind of climate. And then you need to actually try and see how to, how to create conditions that approximate your reference site. That's the broad, and this is something that I've found when I've looked at ecological restoration material over the years. This is something that is kind of basic to any kind of restoration practice. Unfortunately, what tends to happen is that people become greedy. You know, I mean, I know of one restoration site, for example, where they started off brilliantly, but then they kept wanting to bring in more and more stuff, almost like an arboretum, almost like a zoo. And then they started facing difficulties because suddenly they were bringing in things that were not perfectly adapted to all those local conditions, because they were getting over ambitious. But almost every single wild place that I've seen in this country, and there are some absolutely beautiful places, both in the plains and in the mountains, there is so much that can be learned about how these ecosystems function, how plants arrange themselves, how they form communities, how they relate to each other, how they relate to moisture, the absence of moisture. But none of this is really properly documented or in the public domain. And one of the things that we want to try and do with the Ecological Restoration Alliance, the ERA that we formed, is to try and share this knowledge as we slowly accumulate little bits of knowledge, which hopefully will become a whole at some point. I'm a bit concerned about the hills. I mean, I don't know the northeastern hills very well, but I sometimes travel to the northwestern Himalaya. And while there are some places I've seen where there's been some noticeable improvement, the hills are really degrading very, very badly. Partly because of people who are moving in, you know, up from the plains, sort of bridge people from Delhi and Bombay and other places like that. At the same time, that what is happening is the kind of depopulation of the villages because they're not finding enough work. So the village, so the local villager is being replaced by people from the cities. And I don't know to what extent this is connected, but then there is a consequent, or there is a certainly a parallel. You know, for example, there's an Australian wattle that has just become rampant now in Kumau, in parts of Kumau. It's probably been introduced by the Forest Department and not by people moving in from Delhi, but it's almost a sign of the times, you know. So I've forgotten why I started talking about the mountains, but I can only talk confidently about parts of Madhya Pradesh that I know really well, parts of Rajasthan that I know really well. Rajasthan is now, I mean, there is so much illegal mining happening all over the state that is happening with the connivance of political bosses, which is why it's happening at all, because they could shut it down if they wanted to. That it's pathetic, but I want to just say something about Rajasthan that has concerned me deeply. In all the traveling that I've done in Rajasthan, we discovered this particular kind of shrubland called the Roi. Have I talked about the Roi before? I have. But Rajasthan is always, Western Rajasthan is always dismissed by foresters as being a wasteland. They don't care to do anything to it. They don't care. They don't, you know. So the question of restoration doesn't occur to them because they say, "Wahan to kuch hai nahi." There's nothing there. When I discovered the Roi and I discovered the word for the Roi, I was particularly thrilled because it you know, there are all these other shrublands in other parts of the world that are carefully conserved. They're tourist hotspots. People love these places. They go hiking and they go camping and they go photographing these places. There's the Garig, the Maki, the Chaparral, the Fynbos, the Mulgarij in Western Australia. And I thought that by introducing a word, by using the word Roi and sort of somehow trying to smuggle it into the vocabulary that people use when they think about the desert or talk about the desert, maybe we can sensitize people to the fact that some of these shrublands are really valuable. That shrublands are just purely in terms of carbon capture, for example, they're thought to be sometimes more effective than forests. And certainly one of the things that I hope to be doing, even when I stop working as an ecological restoration person, which is probably going to happen quite soon, is to continue to try and influence the Forest Department to pay special attention to the Roi and the role that it plays in the desert. And in similar fashion in Madhya Pradesh, it's the meadow, you know, the meadow in a dry deciduous forest tends to be, from a long-term perspective, quite an ephemeral thing. There's always this tension between trees trying to invade meadows and meadows forming where trees have been edged out either by fires or floods or by human action. But the fact that we tend to be looking at a meadow as a site that needs tree planting just feels terribly wrong. So again, the idea of the meadow, which is a little bit like a Ruhi trunk, you know, taken out of its context and placed in the Madhya Pradesh context, is something that I'd love to spend more time working on and writing about, perhaps even making a little, you know, presentation, a little PPT, and being able to influence the Forest Department about. These are things that concern me now. I'm hoping to create a journal style book about the Central Ridge. The Central Ridge is degraded as it is, invaded as it is by, you know, Prosopis juliflora and increasingly by Subabul. It's an amazing place because the soil is intact. The soil is living. All the microorganisms that live in the soil have not been bombarded with toxic chemicals and other things like that. And I just hope that I can, you know, by taking a Ratpati forest like that, taking a degraded forest like that, and being able to write about it, and not just about the plants, but about the insects and the reptiles and the butterflies and the mushrooms and the mycelium, maybe one can spark an awareness about how even a forest like this, in its degraded state, can be such a valuable asset to a city like Delhi.
Apart from what you've already mentioned, are there any additional systemic challenges in the field of restoration in our country, and how may they be remedied?
I think the biggest systemic challenge is simply that restoration is not something that is taught to a forester. I think it has to be. It should be the bedrock on which all forestry operations work. If they can understand the complexity of a natural system, if they can understand how to coax a degraded piece of land towards becoming more diverse and becoming more like, you know, its exemplar kind of ecology, I think that's the major problem. And so we have this opportunity where you have central training for all the state cadres of forest officers. So it's something that we at ERA have started to talk about. We hope to create a curriculum, as I mentioned before, and to see whether we can, you know, whether we can enter the ways in which foresters learn to think about their wild places. I think that would be a really, really important step. But influencing policy at a, you know, at a political level, that's another cup of tea. I feel totally inadequate in terms of advocacy, in terms of, you know, being able to influence any of that. I feel more like a bystander who sort of watches things happening, usually for the worse, and not somebody who can actively sort of influence the way things work out.
I don't think I've asked you this before, but I was also wanting to know if in the field of restoration and or conservation, are there people in particular who have you've been inspired by their work, or they've influenced your work in any way?
Not really. Very early on, mm-hmm. When I was starting to, I mean, even before I was working in Rajasthan, I think, I met Suprabhasation from the Gurukula sanctuary in Wayanad, and visited two or three times, and was very, very impressed by this private botanic sanctuary and the kind of thinking and the kind of work that they were doing.
When would these visits have been?
This was probably around 2000, 2001, maybe somewhere around then. This is before I was actually involved in working in Rajasthan. But they were not, you know, they were not doing so much sort of active restoration as kind of passive restoration, which also has its place. But I think I was most impressed by the fact that, you know, there was a community of people who were thinking and talking and dreaming about ecological things. I don't think that I know anybody else in this country or abroad for that matter, except for people I've heard of abroad, but nobody that I know of who were a model or were a, you know, offered me a prototype of how to do things. I really had to learn my own and make my own mistakes. And I think making your own mistakes is a great teacher.
I think in all these sessions, again, you've probably addressed these and the question I want to ask in bits and pieces, but just again, for a more focused and pointed view, I want to ask, what is your vision for conservation in India over the next 50 years?
Gosh, I don't know whether I have an answer for that, Preeti. It's not so much a vision as a hope, I think. I just hope that, I think one thing that has happened in some other countries of the world is that you come to the brink, you come to the very edge of the precipice, and that's when you start looking down, you learn how to pull back. I think that India will probably only learn, you know, at the political level, will only sort of address these issues when you come to a huge crisis. We already have a huge crisis of air quality in places like Delhi. That alone doesn't seem to matter enough. But I think that a time can come when, a time will come when, for example, issues about the availability of fresh water could become major for people who are in charge of policy and planning. And that's when perhaps connections can be made between, you know, forests and fresh water and rivers and things like that. And so it's my hope would be that some of these connections will actually hit home. They will strike home to people who matter. Unfortunately, politics tends to be a very, you know, short-term thinking thing. You know, people think about the next elections or about, you know, appealing to a particular kind of constituency only now. I don't know how one can hope to have a political class or a political spectrum that actually learns to think about important things in the long term. And unless that happens, we're never going to be able to address these issues. I don't think I have anything else to say on this particular issue, Preeti. I mean, 50 years is a long time. I'm not going to be around, but I'm not sitting here feeling, you know, that, oh God, people are going to learn, you know. But maybe they will. Maybe they will come so close to a disaster that they'll have to pull back and take important decisions that are perhaps unpopular in the short term, but are meaningful in the long term. And I hope that happens.
I was also wanting to ask about how do you envision the future of wild species and spaces, and what gives you worry and what gives you hope? Again, like I think because we've been speaking for so long, you probably address this in some ways, but if you were to specifically say that there are things that give you some hope or worry, or how do you think, even if you're not able to elaborate upon a specific vision, what do you foresee will eventually end up happening?
I mean, look, I've traveled extensively in central India's jungles, both national parks, tiger reserves, as well as reserved forests and some of the other PAs. And What I'm seeing, I think, is that, I mean, some of the national parks are gorgeous. They're absolutely wonderful. I think they will continue to be if the right buttons are pressed, will continue to be, you know, as important as they are now to the animals that actually live there. What I'm also seeing, however, is that the kind of infrastructure, the kind of, you know, the kind of buildings, the kind of roads, the kind of aesthetics, the kind of taste that with which things are done in almost all these places is something we're going to be very ashamed of. You look at the Central Ridge. Yesterday I was on the Central Ridge, and they've taken the, you know, for some unknown reason, they're broadening the roads. There are JCBs whizzing up and down the Central Ridge now. They've got terrible cement curb stones this big that are standing upright instead of being on their sides. I mean, it's almost as though the people who do all these things just don't seem to have had the right kind of training or exposure. You can't trust them to take the right decision, even in terms of just aesthetics. You go to the FRI and the old building is wonderful, but the new buildings are dreadful. So there's something that needs to be done very drastically to educate people who are in charge of these things, to get them to expose them to things that are happening better. I've read today that there's a complaint by the cheetah experts in Namibia and South Africa that with all these cheetah deaths that are happening in Kuno, they're being kept in the dark. No information is being shared with them. They're not being asked anything. And they said that you guys have no experience of cheetahs. Why are you not talking to us? Why are you not asking us? You know, and this is typical. It's typical of the way the Forest Department thinks and works. And it's typical of the way the government of India thinks and works, you know. So these are, for me, just terribly telltale signs that we haven't, you know, we're not allowed to admit that we made a mistake. We're not allowed to admit that, okay, maybe we need to change course. We're not allowed to actually say, well, okay, we've made a commitment to a particular idea. Let's follow through with it. They're always trying to smuggle something in from the side. So it's I'm sorry to sound so negative, but it is. I do have a very pessimistic view of the way we're operating today in the field of conservation. Whether it's compensatory afforestation, I mean, it's a joke. You know, it's a complete joke.
Is there anything that gives you hope?
Gives me hope. Just the kind of people that I've been meeting, who are, you know, individuals who are working in the ecological restoration field. They're just wonderful people. They're doing it for love. Very few of them are doing it for money. I mean, money is not the major driving force there. And they're doing it because they really care. And that, I mean, I think that's, but that, you know, we're so marginalized as a community that I don't see us having a huge role to play unless something breaks, something changes.
Are there any ways you think this community could grow?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this community will grow if we can demonstrate with actual pieces on the ground how wonderful restoration can be. As long as we're working in tiny little plots, it's not going to make much of a difference. But if we can actually get hold of one large chunk of jungle, perhaps with people living in it, I think that could become a really important exemplar of what restoration can do. And that would make a big difference. Because if you can actually see evidence of something that, you know, that is being touted as being good, that makes a big difference. Otherwise, it's just a theoretical idea somewhere.
I've come to the end of all the specific questions that I had, mm-hmm. but before we wrap up, I would like to know if there's anything you think we haven't yet spoken about as yet that you would just like to add before we finish, or if there are any issues that we didn't touch upon that you think are worth speaking about.
I think we've covered quite a lot of ground, Preeti. I'll probably think of something tomorrow, but today I think this is great, and thank you so much. You've been a wonderful interlocutor, and I hope this I hope when people listen to this 50 years down the line, they have reasons to smile and say, "Well, it turned out a lot better than you thought it was going to be."
I hope so too. And thank you so much for your time and patience over all these sessions. It
You're
was
welcome.
lovely listening and learning from you.
Thank you
I'll
so much.
Stop the recording for now.